This is Spectrum.
Alternative myths, homeopathy, secret society, hypnosis, the paranormal, alternative energy, UFO abduction, the weird, the wild, and the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan here with my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Hi, Scott, how you doing?
I'm good. Doing great. Been a busy week. Lots going on out there. Occupy movement's pretty much popping up in every city. Wow.
Worldwide, actually.
Worldwide. I mean, it's worldwide. When I was talking to Adam, he was aware of, like, you know, 60 or 70 of them. And I think it's the number's a hell of a lot more now. I think we're into the hundreds at this point.
For sure.
With the Occupy movement. And you know what? More power to them. I just hope it's not co-opted, you know, like every other, you know, movement in the past has been co-opted. But you know what? Good luck steering a wave. Speaking of waves, tonight's guest created a tsunami when he published his book, The Gods of Eden. William Bramley spent 7 years trying to understand the root causes of war before disclosing his startling conclusions in The Gods of Eden. In the book, he reveals that UFOs, or the gods, and other strange beings associated with UFOs may have shaped human society from the deepest antiquity. Readers of Zachariah Sitchin will find many familiar themes in Bramley's analysis. William Bramley has uncovered the sinister thread that links humanity's darkest events, from the wars of the ancient pharaohs to the assassination of JFK. In this remarkable, shocking, and absolutely compelling work, Bramley presents disturbing evidence of an alien presence on Earth, extraterrestrial visitors who have conspired to dominate humankind through violence and chaos from the beginning of time, a conspiracy which continues to this very day. Spectrum Radio Network is proud to welcome William Bramley. Hello, William. How you doing? William Bramley. Hi, William. Nice to have you on the show.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this interview. You wrote two books, The Gods of Eden, and help me out with this name, Jesus Goes to Hollywood?
Yeah, that's correct.
What a great title for a book.
Oh, thanks. My sister actually came up with that one, so I have her to thank for it.
Okay, I usually start out in these shows by asking about the history of the people we're involving. How did you get involved in looking into these subjects, these topics?
Well, it began really in high school. When I was a high school senior, I took a sociology class in my high school, and it sort of opened up my eyes to the idea that there are forces, that there are other things than just the obvious that perhaps shape human events, that cause society to become what it is, other than what seems to be really obvious. And so at that time, I was part of the, this was back in the late 60s. I became a college student in 1970. So the anti-war movement was really going strong at that time. And it was really a movement of philosophy. A lot of people think it was just hippies with a peace sign and maybe some riots and things, but there was a lot more to it than that. There was this whole questioning of authority. There was a whole questioning about reality and politics and fundamentally looking at whether, basically it was an objection to war at a much deeper level, not just Vietnam, but war in general. And so that kind of shaped, really, I feel, my goal. It was to, well, find out what is really the basis of war. Why do we even go to war? It seems so stupid. It seems so counterproductive. And most rational people realize that, and yet it seems to be something that we keep getting involved in over and over and over again. So then an idea was introduced to me there in the sociology class when I got to college, was that you know, you read Niccolo Machiavelli, who wrote The Prince. The Prince is this classic text where he talks about that there are people who profit or benefit by creating war. It doesn't really matter why people are fighting wars. It just is, as long as they're fighting, there's a benefit that somebody gets from that. And so then I started getting interested in that aspect of it. Well, who profits from the existence of war itself, regardless of why people are fighting the wars, and therefore who has a motive to kind of stoke wars, to keep them going? And so I really started off wanting to just explore that aspect of war, but it led down some really, really strange paths. I mean, back then as college students, I was in the University of California, you know, my friends and I were exploring all kinds of ideas,
yep,
and theories and thoughts. But I kind of went off on this very unusual path. It took a while. And then I started looking at religion, because people point out, well, you know, religion seems to trigger a lot of this, that even people who don't profit from it in the obvious ways, you know, like armaments manufacturers, of course, profit from war regardless of why people are fighting them. So that's one aspect. Bankers do, too, if they make loans to governments during war.
Right.
But then you got to this point, well, what about religion? Religion seems to be the ideological, for a lot of people anyway, ideologically the reason why people who make no profit will go to war. They'll get all excited, you know, based upon some religious idea. You know, you see that in the radical jihadists, in the radical Jews, and the radical Christians. You see that, especially in the three Abrahamic religions, you see a lot of that.
Right.
And so I thought, well, okay, well, that's very interesting. And so where did these religions come from? And then they talk about the priest class and so forth. But then you start running into this weird thing. Well, everybody who has these visions from the so-called angels and these entities, they say that these human-like things that come out of the sky and tell them and give them these apocalyptic prophecies and they should go and fight somebody else. And most people say, well, that's just myth. That's just the priests creating myth. But then as soon as you look at it, you know, you start running into the ancient astronaut theory. And there's probably no sociology professor in the world who's willing to go that far. That's the only step that I took, really, beyond the priests.
You found it a little bit curious that God would send a host of his, you know, followers or angels down to the humans and say, see those people out there? I don't like them as much as I like you. So you need to go wipe those people out, because you're my people, not them. God created everything, but you know what? I made a couple of mistakes with those. If you could clean those up for me, that would be great. And you thought, well, hey, that's a little odd. And then, of course, they go and write books about them and call them holy.
Right. And you got it exactly right. That's exactly the issue that I wanted to look at, was this idea of, I'm God's chosen and you're not, therefore we get to kill you. And therefore we're commanded to kill you. And that's been a real, real problem. You look at the New Testament, you look at the history of the other religions, even outside the Abrahamic religions from ancient times, they were getting similar messages. I mean, you have the Egyptians were given similar messages through the pharaohs and through their secret societies in ancient Egypt, and they were doing battle. So what I basically came up with, just to make the long story short, was that you then run into the work of Zechariah Sitchin. Anybody who gets into ancient astronauts will run into his works, and I highly recommend them, where he analyzes the ancient creation stories. And sure enough, what you find is that you have this ET phenomenon, the same little grays. You find them depicted going back thousands of years. You find these human-like ETs flying in these circular objects or bright objects in the sky, reported in the New Old Testament and reported outside of the Old Testament and the old Mesopotamian creation stories. They were the supposed leaders of our civilization, of human civilization, a long time ago, and that they genetically engineered this race, the Homo sapiens, and as a tool of keeping control, they used the Machiavellian formula that Machiavelli later wrote about centuries later in his book, The Prince, that basically what you do to keep control over this large population is you keep fomenting wars amongst them, keep them distracted with wars. And that seemed to be the exact pattern that came out. And in fact, when you look at the Mesopotamian creation stories, there are a couple of tablets that talk exactly about that was their intention. And how they had the ability to foment wars amongst human beings. And that's also reflected in the Tower of Babel story. Now, the Tower of Babel story came from these earlier creation stories of Mesopotamia, where they talk about the many gods. Some of these books in Genesis of the Old Testament are actually reworkings of older stories that talked about the many gods. And so, yeah, Tower of Babel. I mean, they talk about, yeah, we the God of the of the Old Testament, which was actually the many gods of the earlier Mesopotamians, said we have to keep people disunited. Well, we can't let them unite. And so then I thought that was very interesting. I mean, here we have a motive. Here we have somebody with a motive, allegedly, for keeping people disunited with all of these different warring factions. And the surprise to me was that it was reported to be these ETs, you know, these extraterrestrials. And that's a hard jump to make, quite honestly.
Well, especially back in those times. I mean, making that leap for you back then must have been like, oh, okay, hold on a minute. I'm going to have to do a little bit more research here. This is really odd. And again, of course, you at that point probably did more research. And did you find out that all the ancient cultures all over the world, it's not just limited to Mesopotamia, which is now the Sumerian tablets and all of that information. Of course, Zachariah Sitchin, who's recently passed away, talked about all of that. So you come across this, and then you find that other cultures all over the world all have this sort of outlook that humans are genetically created. You know, they may not use the terms we use today. You know, they use more, you know, metaphorical or descriptive terms. But humans are genetically manipulated and socially manipulated, which is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you find it in the ancient American stories, their creation stories. So you find there are two intentions basically expressed that these ET creators supposedly had. One is keep people disunited as a means of simply controlling the population to keep them from gathering together and rising up against the occupier or the oppressor, which in that case was the ET, and also keeping people fundamentally ignorant. And that was also expressly stated in some of these old creation stories. That's really the basis of the Adam and Eve story, is that you keep human beings fundamentally ignorant about certain important things, mostly of a spiritual nature, about the fundamental nature of reality and how reality works. You know, what's the universe really composed of? What's the relationship of consciousness to the universe? Basically, to put a wall of ignorance there. And so that, and to keep people struggling at a very earthy level, that's also part of the Adam and Eve story, that living from birth until death just becomes this all-consuming struggle. You know, you're just struggling every day, every week, just for sustenance, just to stay alive as a physical human being, which then gives you less time to really explore the questions, the more fundamental questions about reality and spirituality and all that. You don't have time. You know, you're so busy feeding yourself and feeding your family.
True.
And so what they talked about in the old creation stories was the intention to set up conditions in which all of these things would be constantly created so that we were always at war, we were always at strife, we were always struggling for most of the people. I mean, yeah, there are a few rich people who don't have to struggle, but that's a small minority. For most people, you know, as soon as, for example, the United States, we reach a middle class, a pretty comfortable middle class, which starts to explore, has more time to explore these things, well, the rug gets pulled out like it has recently. Now we're losing that middle class. But all the mechanisms to do that were set up through this network of secret societies that were created way back in Mesopotamian times, that came through Egypt, and that have actually had existence all the way up until today. And we find that the same network of these secret societies have continued basically to create these conditions through one means or another, and seem to ultimately be the source of a lot of this. So that became the theory of the gods of Eden, that it's just been this ongoing thing, that as long as we keep seeing UFOs in the sky, as long as they keep getting reported, then the hypothesis or the theory of the gods of Eden is that we will continue to see these conditions, that these conditions will continue to be fomented constantly. And so we still see that connection even today. I haven't really done a lot of research since writing the gods of Eden. I can't say I've done in-depth research on modern events, but I can just note, just reading the news and all that, that the same types of sources to our problems continue to cause those problems that I discuss in the Gods of Eden. And we continue to have a UFO presence. Now, some people say, well, that's kind of a crazy connection. How do you make the connection between UFOs today and what's happening in terms of the economy and what's happening in terms of the strife? All I can say is basically read the book, and hopefully that will then explain where that connection comes in. I hope I've described that okay. I tend to get kind of wordy, and I apologize if I kind of babble on.
No, it's perfectly fine. Be as wordy as you like. I love wordy guests because it means they have a lot to express.
So, Bill, can you give us a brief history of the these brotherhoods, these societies out there, and how they developed?
Yeah, if you look at the old Mesopotamian creation stories, the creator gods, the ones that we analyze today in the UFO field as having genetically created Homo sapiens, that is the modern version of Homo sapiens. There seem to have been humans around for a very long time, but what we call modern Homo sapiens sapiens, that there was a genetic creation. Those creator gods were also said to have created a network of secret societies. There's one in particular, one god, creator god in particular called Enki, who was associated with the symbol of the snake. And that he tried to impart certain spiritual wisdom to the human race. But what you see is in the development of this secret society that had this snake symbol, which was very prominent in ancient Egypt with the pharaohs. You find the snake symbol all over their mystery schools and their various brotherhoods. They weren't there to teach people these lessons. That's the big mistake I think a lot of people make when they talk about them, how they had all this esoteric wisdom, and if we could only decipher these old symbols, we'd return to that kind of knowledge. The purpose of those societies was to simply block knowledge. The reason knowledge was put into symbols was so people couldn't understand it. The idea was, well, it's so precious, it's so important, we can't let the profane have it. And only the elite should be able to have this kind of sacred, super secret knowledge of a spiritual nature. But when you really look at the history of those organizations, the knowledge even within those secret societies would also eventually vanish. I mean, the purpose of it was to say, oh, yeah, we have all this wonderful wisdom, and only a few of us are going to be allowed to have it, but in fact, the actual effect of it was to wipe it out and to replace it with a lot of superstition, with weird rituals and weird symbols and just a lot of, if I may say so, crap on your show. That's basically what it got replaced with. Now, these same secret societies were also then, you look at the history of the Abrahamic religions, they were also the source of some of these ancient prophets who talked about the apocalypse, who said, okay, there's going to be this great apocalypse and we need to go out and go to war with other people. That also came through those same secret societies. And the Old Testament's a good source of that. You also find it, for example, I even talk about Muhammad a little bit in the book, his vision there in the cave when he saw these entities come in. It basically is like a UFO abduction scenario where he was immobilized and then given this message, which was also, okay, now he's going to go out and go fight with a lot of people. And so you find that, and going through as a common thread through these different groups. And what I do in the Gods of Eden, and I trace these groups all the way up until today. Well, I should say up until 20 years ago when I stopped, when I wrote the book. And you find the same things. You find this symbolic apron amongst the Templars, and they were very much involved in some of the revolutions that were going on, like in the 1800s and the 1700s. And you find them then instituting some of these systems here in the Western world. Now, some of the revolutions, like the American Revolution, I think there was a lot of good behind that. But they set up this monetary system, though, that is now a cause of a lot of the problems that we're having. And I trace that also back to this weird shadowy network that goes back even earlier. So basically you trace it, and then you look at even today, I didn't talk a lot about it in my book, but I include like political intelligence agencies in the secret society network. They operate that way. They tend to be autonomous by law. You find that they are often founded by people who were members of these more esoteric secret societies. And you find that that becomes the channel then through which a lot of the material, the money, the weapons are then provided to these different factions to keep them fighting. So they become sort of an extension of that whole network. So it's no surprise, anybody who reads the Garden of Eden is not going to be surprised to learn that all of a sudden the United States is providing weapons to Mexican drug runners. We think it's a big shock, but that's the pattern of history that happens. We're supporting the Mexican government on the one hand against the drug runners, the drug gangs, but then on the other hand, we're secretly providing weapons to some of them. This kind of system where you're providing information and support to both sides of a conflict, we see it played out all the time in news headlines. Sadly, a lot of that comes from the United States, but Britain's also involved. It used to come more from Germany. In my book, I talk about Germany being the source of a lot of that in fairly recent centuries. But I think that has shifted now more to the United States and to the Anglican world after that. So that's why, you look at, for example, it's such an irony to me. You look at the fact that, okay, here we are supporting Israel, right? And, I look at let me repeat that or say it over again. We're supporting Israel, but at the same time, we're supporting Saudi Arabia. We have that famous picture of George Bush holding the hand of the Sheikh of Saudi Arabia. But in the meantime, we're saying that we're friends of Israel. But where does a lot of the anti-Jewish sentiment come from? It comes from Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabi sect. The Wahhabis are headquartered basically in Saudi Arabia. They are the source of a lot of the radicalism that is happening in the Middle East, in which Israel is opposed. And in the meantime, then you have some of the more radical Israeli clerics who think, they preach that non-Jews are dogs who could just be killed at will. Now, most Israelis don't follow that teaching, but it's still something that is being taught by some of them over there. And it seeps into some of the military. I mean, it seeps into some of the attitudes of their leadership over there. And here we are supporting both sides. But again, that comes as no surprise, because that's what you have to do to keep warfare alive. You have to support both sides, and you have to have both sides be equally good in their own way and equally bad in their own way. And that's what keeps all of this going. So we kind of see evidence of that today, I believe, just from what I've been reading in the newspapers and seeing on the news. I don't see any change in the patterns that I talk about in the Garden of Eden.
Okay, so this is a reoccurring thing.
Exactly, yeah. It just constantly keeps going, yeah.
All right.
As far as the Neanderthals that existed before, where did we come in, this new human? And what happened to the Neanderthals?
Yeah, well, the Neanderthals, they vanished. There's this murky point in anthropology where there was this sudden jump, and they call us Homo sapiens sapiens. They use the word sapiens twice in the designation. Now, I'm not entirely clear myself on exactly where the jump happened. All I know is that modern Homo sapiens sapiens appeared somewhere between 10 and 30,000 years ago. That's what a lot of the estimates are. Now, there were other forms of humans before that, maybe going back, at least a couple hundred thousand years, and there's even evidence of some kind of human existence here on Earth, even going back maybe 1 or 2 million years. So there have been these different forms of human on Earth, some of them more primitive, like you talked about Neanderthal. But the one that I focused on was the sudden jump to us, to Homo sapiens sapiens. Exactly where the cutoff happened between Neanderthal and I'm not exactly sure. All I know is, yeah, Neanderthal disappeared, and here we are.
Yeah, where there's different versions. There's, you know, human version 1.0, 1.2. They seem to keep getting patched. There's like version patches coming on. It's like we're like iPods. Keep getting upgraded.
Yeah, but didn't they say recently that, you know, we exist, you know, humans exist at the same time as Neanderthals at some point?
There was an overlap, perhaps. Yeah, there is a theory that there was an overlap and that the humans that, the new humans, wiped out whatever Neanderthals were left. I mean, they just literally hunted them down and killed them. So that is one theory. But I'm not sure, is that the entire reason why they were wiped out? Maybe it was. I mean, that's one theory that's around. To me, the bigger mystery is, where's that missing link? We talk about the evolution, that basically human beings and all animals just gradually evolve, and you should be able to find this very nice sequence. But that didn't happen. The jump was somewhat abrupt. Some people were looking for the missing link. They found this creature called Lucy. You know, this is back decades ago, and now even Lucy, this creature, the skeleton they found that seemed to be halfway between us and Neanderthal, turned out not to really be the missing link after all. So that's really been the big puzzle in anthropology. Now, some people think they figured it out, but then a lot of other anthropologists say, no, you still don't have the answer. So there's still debate about all of that. But the creation story that our ancestors told us was of genetic manipulation, that there's somebody tinkering with all of this. They bred them, and boom, here we are. And that was basically the Sitchin analysis of the Mesopotamian stories. And it was also in the Popol Vuh, the ancient American creation story, talked about something very similar to that, about this tinkering, about this effort to create a new creature, you know, all these different experiments, some of which were not successful until finally they came up with, aha, here we go. We finally got what we want. Now this is the new creature on Earth. And that brings another issue, too. You know, I get kind of concerned when I read about these hybrids that supposedly are being bred now. A lot of the abductees are talking about they're abducted. They are experimented with. There's some procedure that's performed of sexual nature or reproductive nature. They're shown these little hybrid babies and creatures that seem to be half human and half ET. And I think Bud Hopkins, the late Bud Hopkins, was one person who talked about that. Dr. David Jacobs is a big one on that. And there have been a couple of others. And it seems to be very consistent. This seems to be a very consistent report.
John Mack, Harvard professor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this seems to be a big part of what's going on right now. Well, I get kind of worried about that because, to me, that sort of harkens back to these old creation stories where out with the old and in with the new. You know, if they're breeding the new evolutionary jump, if that's what's happening, if that's what a lot of this abduction scenario is all about, and Dr. Jacobs thinks that it's a large-scale program, it's not just a little bit of tinkering with a few people now and again. I mean, this is a large-scale breeding program. You know, are we getting set up for elimination? And then the next so-called evolutionary jump will be introduced. You know, now I'm kind of getting off into some pretty wild speculation. But, you know, as soon as I start reading about these things, I get a little concerned because of the old creation stories, which talk about something very similar having happened, you know, a few tens of thousands of years ago. You know, my question is, well, is that being set up now again? Is that what the future holds in store? I hope not. I hope I'm totally off on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? The interesting thing is that you're allowed to speculate. You're allowed to go, hey, isn't it interesting that a lot of the UFO, and Tom has, being the president of MUFON Ontario for so many years, he's handled, I know, hundreds of abduction cases. I've handled some myself.
Yeah, I really respect MUFON, by the way. Great organization, so I hope they keep going.
Yeah, more power to them. I think they've been slightly co-opted, but what doesn't get co-opted, really?
Eventually, yeah.
Okay. But I think that there is a connection, possibly. It's definitely worth looking into and thinking about that if these things are reported over and over. I mean, Tom, you've heard this. Countless times now about the hybrid thing,
least.
You know, And we had a case here in a local case that I handled with my research partner. And it was the damnedest thing. The woman had had three children already, and, you know, she was pregnant, and the baby just, you know, disappeared without miscarry. And, you know, we had information from her and from her doctor, and she had a hole just above her crotch area that was about 2 inches deep, and like if you took a cigarette and just a lit cigarette and burned down, it was about 2 inches deep, a quarter inch in circle, and I couldn't explain it. It was just odd, and it was one of those things. So maybe she was part of that program. I don't know. I wasn't with her when the supposed abduction happened. All I can do is write down her report and, you know, and take pictures and talk to the doctor and say, there was a baby there, right? And yeah, the baby's gone now, right? Yeah. Can you explain that? Well, I can. She miscarried, you know, but apparently she has no evidence. She has no understanding that that was what happened.
Yeah, I mean, of course you have to look into those possibilities. I do believe that the proper way to research all of these things is first you do look for the prosaic explanation. Yeah, she miscarried or she had an abortion and she didn't want to tell anybody about it. That would be the most logical explanation. But on the other hand, if you get enough of these reports, which you do, about carrying a baby and then suddenly it disappears and there's been UFO abduction activities surrounding that person, yeah, then it does become a logical issue about whether or not there it was something that the ETs did go ahead and take that baby. And then you connect that to all the people who report seeing their children or seeing...
And having to hold them.
Yeah, you know, eventually a lot of scientists don't like these types of things because they say, well, there's no hard proof. We don't have a dead alien baby laying on the ground that we can pick up and photograph. That's kind of how they want to go with it. But the thing is, anecdotal evidence is good evidence. We use it in courts of law. If there's enough of it, you finally form a pattern that you have to say, you know, this becomes pretty convincing after a while. Yeah, if it's just one or two people, you'd wonder, well, is this for real or not? But when it's as many as we've seen from as many researchers, including yourself, the case that you looked at, and it's so consistent in different parts of the world or different parts of the country, you have to start taking it seriously. You can't say, well, I won't believe any of this until I see a dead alien baby or a live alien baby dropped on the White House lawn. You know, we can't expect that. I think there's something going on with all of this. I think it might be tremendously significant for our future as to what's going on. You know, Dr. Jacobs, he got into a little hot water. I guess it was one person he had hypnotized that then spoke out against him. But before that, he had even met her. He had already published a book called The Threat, which was published in 1998. And he talked about a lot of this. And, you know, what a lot of these abductees are being told, they're being told, hey, yeah, we're breeding these babies, and they're being told this by the ETs. We're breeding these babies, but don't worry. Everything's going to be wonderful. We're going to all live in harmony on Earth, and it's all going to be peace and love. Okay. But a lot of these abductees are also being said, well, but in the meantime, there's going to be this great catastrophe is going to happen, and we're not going to tell you what it is. ETs are not going to tell these abductees what this great catastrophe is going to be, but there's going to be something coming up. So, and that concerns me, you know, that basically there's something that we're not going to like connected to this whole program. Now, Dr. Jacobs just thought it's just going to be that they are very authoritarian, that they're very controlling, that the society that we would live in, if it were integrated with them, would not be a happy society. We would not enjoy it. And that might be, perhaps, I mean, it's a good theory. Again, my theory that maybe it's a total replacement scenario, I don't have any more proof for that than probably have less proof for that than Dr. Jacobs does for his theory that it's just an integration.
That's okay. They've been looking for the Higgs boson for quite a while now, and they haven't found that yet either.
Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to just harken back a little bit about we can make some sort of a connection. I wanted to ask you about what are the king rats?
Well, the king rats is a term that I use in the book to talk about the human elites who profit from these conditions. And I base it on the book by James Clavell called King Rat. It was made into a movie, too, and I recommend everybody watch it. It was back in the, it was a few decades ago. It was one of those old World War II movies. Anyway, the King Rat, the story takes place in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. And the prisoners, the American prisoners, have set up this little society with one guy at the top. He kind of controls the goods. He's able to sell the eggs. And he kind of gets rich within that structure. And it's significant because at the very end of the movie, the camp is finally liberated. And in the army, he was just a corporal. But within this prison structure, within the structure of this oppressive society where they're actually in prison, he became more than a corporal. He became kind of the king. He ruled over everybody. Now, in the book and in the movie, he was sort of a sympathetic character. He actually turned out to be a nice guy. But the point of the movie is that at the very end, the camp is liberated, and he's just, without that prison structure, without all the oppression, he has now just become another corporal, just to be shipped off and sent back to the United States with everybody else. So I kind of use that term to describe the human elites that profit and that keep their position of supremacy because of the wars that are generated, because of the strife that's generated, and because of the monetary system that keeps us in a condition of always struggling and not being able to kind of overcome our ability to have to work from dawn until dusk just to make ends meet, that those elites, they make a tremendous profit from it, but ultimately they are prisoners of the same system that we are, just like the King Rat was in the story. And in a way, everybody's better off, even the King Rats, ultimately with the liberation, you know, that you get rid of all of that. Yeah, the King Rats who profited from it, you know, let's say the wars stop and Lockheed Martin no longer can make all these weapons and the banks can't, you know, make billions and billions of dollars by lending money or causing these problems. You know, they will think that their position is somehow reduced, but in fact, everybody benefits by getting rid of these conditions, by everybody being liberated. So the King Rats, to me, are those human elites who participate in this, who help create these conditions for their own profit, and usually they are just profit-motivated. But interestingly enough, you'll then find connections with some of these. You go deeply enough, you start finding connections to these people, to intelligence services occasionally, you find to secret societies of their own. And so you find that same agenda that goes a little bit deeper kind of carried through them in some occasions. Most of them are just there profit-motivated. Most of them are not there to, you know, knowingly keep those conditions alive because there's another layer to this whole thing that I speculate about. But I still call them the King Rats. And other people give them other names, but that's the name that I give to them.
Yeah, so you're talking about the elites, the Illuminati, the many names that have been given to them, the kings of old, the monarch system, all of that sort of rule from the top that have many arms, the arms being religion and military and, you know, social structure, creating an education system that got co-opted. It seems that anything out there that is dealing directly on the ground level with people is co-opted. And you can look at it, go through the research and look into it. The education system, oh, Rockefeller is connected to that. Mm-hmm. And the secret society is connected to secret wisdom or secret knowledge. Well, if it's so special, you know, why don't you just give it out to everybody? Why does there have to be this divide? Oh, you can't handle the truth? Are we living in a movie?
Yeah, I agree with you. No, that's, to me, it's sort of like, I feel like we've come to the point now where I want to say to these people, and I guess I've said it a little bit in the book and I've said it in an interview, you know, like to the Freemasons and all of that. And by the way, all of these secret societies, they change over time. You know, sometimes they're significant for a certain period of history and then they're not so significant anymore. And then a new secret society kind of takes its place. So you know, the American Freemasons today, I don't think are terribly significant in terms of what I talk about, although the European Freemasons might be more so. But anyway, what I say to all of them, like the Rosicrucians and anybody who has a secret tradition, they think that they have this special knowledge either about history, or they think they have special knowledge about science, or about religion or spirituality, just publish it now. You know, enough of this stuff where you're going to keep it secret and you have to join the organization and do these rituals and wear these sashes and things like that. And because I'll tell you, a lot of people are disappointed when they finally get to the top, when they finally reach that secret knowledge. You know, they've gone all the way to the 33rd degree of the Freemasons or something, and they, you know, some of them go, "What? This is it? This was the big secret." So they might still remain members because they like that whole social thing, or maybe they can kind of keep it weird, you know, mysterious enough to themselves that they still feel like there's a mystery.
And blood rituals are just so much fun.
Yeah, there is a lot of that. That's why most people are members of these things. They're not there for sinister reasons at all. You know, I've been personally acquainted with a couple of Freemasons, and very nice people. I know they're not doing anything sinister, and I know that their local lodges are not doing anything sinister. But going back in history, even they will acknowledge, there was more political significance to their organizations back 200 years ago, and that's what I talk about. But I say to all of them now, look, we're at the point I feel like we just need to put everything on the table now. Let's just put it all on the table and quit doing this game. You know, what it'll do, though, it'll damage a lot of these groups because there's no more, how do they recruit people? They can't recruit people based upon, hey, we've got this great secret, and you need to join us and participate if you want to learn this great secret about the meaning of the universe. We take away that stuff from them, but at the same time, I think humanity is at the point where it just needs that now. Enough, I say enough of all of this.
Yeah, I think the younger generation would say, "Yeah, whatever, you got a secret, I'll just find out on the internet." Thanks.
Exactly.
Yeah. You could nowadays.
Yeah.
So, Bill, I want to ask you now: a human being is supposed to be a spiritual entity, right?
Well,
how do we compare to these other entities, whoever they may be?
Well, you know, I think there's very strong evidence in the near-death studies that have been done and all of that, that the consciousness is something separate from the body. And that's the consciousness is maybe what we call the soul, that it has its own awareness, its own identity, and that it's an element that's not part of the flesh and blood that it occupies. So I think reincarnation is a real thing. So that's how I define that. It's not that we're more or less spiritual than the ETs. I just think we're, in terms of the fundamental consciousness, I think, is fundamentally of the same quality or the same type of substance.
It's just whatever filter you're wearing at the time. We're the biological units we're wearing over our consciousness has many filters. That's all we have to go by, really.
Yeah, but
it's an analogy other people have made is that it's just like the driver in a car. You know, we kind of get stuck on looking at the car, especially if you're driving in L.A. All you see are cars, and you tend to lose sight of the fact that there are human beings with personalities inside of each of those cars. And so that is sort of an analogous situation to the body, that we kind of see that there is individuality and personality in everybody, even when we look at them as a body. But we see that only in the body, I think, is an error, that it's the consciousness that animates it that is really the source of all of that, that is separable, that does leave the body at death and probably is wind up in other bodies later on through a reincarnation process. And for that, you know, I really do look at the near-death studies. I think there have been a lot of them. They were done more frequently several decades ago, but I think they're very convincing.
Several decades ago, I did a 2-year research project on them.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, you probably know more about it than I do. But I'm convinced that there's a reality there, and that's what I talk about. And when I look at the old creation stories, that the Adam and Eve story and what they talked about and some of the tablets was that knowledge or having a true understanding of all that was meant to be blocked. And that's part of that knowledge that we were not meant to know. We're supposed to be superstitious about it. We're supposed to not understand it as a method of control. So that became part of the theory of the gods of Eden. And that's why one reason why I believe that we are so ignorant. We're sort of left with two choices, you know. Some of the mainstream religions, they tell us, okay, you got to believe in this great apocalyptic God who goes out and has people killed, or you have to be a total atheist and believe that it's all just flesh and blood and, you know, knock on wood, materialism. So we're not given real good options here. And to me, the truth lies, you know, more towards the spiritual. But at the same time, I like science because I like to understand how the material functions work. You know, like quantum physics, of course, is very interesting in that we're starting to see that really the universe requires an observer in order for it to exist. You know, something has to be observing the universe in order for it to even appear to be there. And that also talks to a consciousness that's separate from the universe. Now, not all physicists agree with that. Some of them think, well, it's just sort of a self-observing universe. But I think there are problems in that theory. I think it really bespeaks the fact that we have to have a consciousness separate from it. So we're living interesting times that way. I mean, I do see some good movement in that direction. But, of course, you get the tension between the scientists who don't like the new agey interpretations to what they're doing. They kind of resent it. And then you get the people who look at it as evidence for more spiritual realities who kind of resent the scientists for being so stubborn in their materialistic view. So anyway, that tends to be how things work out, but I think we're making progress in that regard. I think we're kind of moving towards greater understanding in all of this.
Yeah, I had a scientist telling me about a paper that he was very excited about where the physicists were talking about intrinsic awareness within the particles. So if you just, you know, think about that, in all, you know, beingness has intrinsic awareness. That's a pretty big leap for physicists. You know, when well, they like to talk about the automobile, not the, you know, not what's driving it. So that's a pretty huge leap. And with quantum physics, they run into all kinds of, you know, all kinds of difficulty with quantum physics where, you know, you have nasty infinities. You know, why would they call an infinity a nasty? Because it's just something they don't want to wrap their head around. And this is the sort of thing that I think is happening. Physicists are discovering that when they discover more and more, they realize it connects more and more to what mystics have been saying for, you know, thousands of years.
Yeah, you know, many of the mystics were really onto something, and they maybe didn't say it in the best way. I don't think they had the total understanding that they could express it in a way that, you know, we could really truly understand it. Unfortunately, right now, we often have to talk in metaphor, you know, about these things, because we don't really truly understand the mechanics of it exactly, and we can't really talk about it in really good mechanical terms in terms of how does the consciousness trigger the information that creates this illusion of a three-dimensional world. You know, we kind of have to talk in metaphors about TVs or computers or make analogies, you know, to other things. So, and that was one of the problems with the mystics, too. They sort of, yeah, they were kind of on the right track, and they came, some of them gave good information, but they still didn't quite have it, just like we do today. We still don't quite have it, but we're kind of merging, I think, on that if we keep going with it. The problem we have today is that so many physicists are employed in the war industries, you know. We have all this enormous brain power, that if we just really put them all to work exploring these kinds of questions, I think we could make some really rapid progress. You know, what is this consciousness that seems to trigger this illusion? You know, really look into that. Do the experiments to test what that is. There was a very good book that came out, I forgot the title of it, that talked about the physicists who were really the founders, like Schrodinger and some of these people who really founded modern quantum physics, which goes back about a century. These are the people they call the great minds who really establish the fact that there's something kind of illusory about this universe. And what some of them said and what the agreement seemed to be, they sort of acknowledged, they all had metaphysical beliefs, believe it or not. They were not these stubborn materialists, which surprised me.
No, they were more along the alchemist line of thinking.
Yeah, you're right. And so they were willing to entertain these other thoughts, but what they said was that science itself, the way it's structured, is not well equipped to deal with it because, yes, science is there to, for example, you have a stove, you know, and science is really good at figuring out how the stove works and, you know, how you turn the knob and why the electricity going through there will make the heater go on. They're really good at that, and science is good at improving on those things. But what science is not good at doing is explaining the observer, explaining the person who's turning the knob. See, and that's sort of right. The analogy that I'm making here. And so that seems to be the tension that maybe we're expecting too much of scientists to be able to make that bridge. But I don't know. I think we almost have to get there, you know, because the consciousness, I think, is an element in all of this. And we can't really ignore the universe without studying the consciousness, I think, in a scientific way. I think we need to know that.
Well, I think there's a lot of areas that, you know, science can potentially help. But academia does not allow it to go in that direction because it's a control mechanism there as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, the science, they want to keep their jobs. So they're going to go teach at the universities. They can't go running around with wild theories. But what I found after The Gods of Eden was written, I was contacted, and this was like 20 years ago, by a group called, maybe you know about them, maybe you're even members, the Society for Scientific Exploration. I don't know. Yeah, it was still around. But at the time,
They're still around.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm glad to hear that. And I was contacted by them after The Gods of Eden came out, and it was actually at the time run by a professor at Stanford University. I mean, and they kind of wanted to explore these different questions. They were exploring UFOs. They actually took my book, The Gods of Eden, some of them my book, seriously. I couldn't believe it. And I had the great pleasure of talking to some of these people, and they even read in their journal once or twice. So you find members, I mean, there were members from major universities who were allowed to do that. Even Dr. Jacobs, for example, with his abduction research, he teaches at Temple University, which is a large, respected university. So there is, in some many universities, leeway for them to explore these things. But you're right, they can't get too much into it with their students.
I'm curious what they said to you.
Oh, we would just talk about the different theories about ancient astronauts and, you know, the theory of my book. They were kind of interested in the nature, like Jacques Vallée was a member at the time. Maybe he still is. You know,
yep.
Jacques Vallée. Yeah. I recommend his books, by the way. I think he's done some fascinating research. And, I met with Jacques Vallée, and we had lunch, and we talked about it, and Their questions really were mostly, you know, what is this what is the ET? Is it really an extraterrestrial from another planet? Is it another dimension? Some people think they're time travelers. I mean, there are all these different theories about what they are. You know, which I don't get really much into in my book. I really just looked at what is their relationship to us, and I kind of gave it a name. I gave them the name of custodians. Basically, they have custody of the Earth and or their property, so to speak, kind of along the lines of Charles Fort, who wrote that book, The Book of the Damned.
True.
But anyway, so that was really, and unfortunately I didn't have a lot to contribute to that discussion because I didn't really get into it. That wasn't really my focus. My focus was just on how are they affecting us. And that's what interested me in Jacques Vallée's work, was Messengers of Deception, I thought was just a fascinating book. So that's the type of thing I think they were kind of getting into. But they, you know, if you have sociologists and historians, they are interested in dynamics, social dynamics, historical dynamics. And that's really more of what The Gods of Eden is about. It's really more about historical dynamics. It's anybody who reads it will kind of see, yeah, this is more of a sociology perspective than it is a hard science perspective on the topic. So that's about all I can report to them. I didn't report to you about them. I didn't really go to many of their functions. After I wrote and published The Gods of Eden, quite honestly, I was pretty exhausted, and I didn't really stay involved in the UFO field that much.
Well, the thing is, it's an incredibly deep rabbit hole for a sociologist to get into, because you have to look at the sociological effects of the ancient writings and how people interacted back then. So I'm sure you were tired.
It's
interesting though. I mean, back then you had cultures all over the world talking about the Star Brothers or the Anunnaki, who came from Nibiru, which is, the Zachariah Sitchin's information, they say it pretty plainly. I mean, you can sure there's a degree of interpretation. You can interpret that that's what they were talking about, but you can interpret it from cultures all over the world. You know, it's like the abduction thing we were talking about earlier. If one or two people have the experience, you can go, okay, well, that's a maybe not that much to it. But if many people have that situation happen to them, then there might be something to it. Well, what about all these ancient cultures who talk about this sort of thing? Maybe there is something to it. I guess that's where you're coming from.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if it was only a few writings in the Old Testament, yeah, all right. You just sort of write it off and figure, okay, that was just their mythology. But then when you see that now the Old Testament did arise out of Mesopotamia, but then you see it there, you see it in Persia, you see it, for example, in some of the religions, the ancient religions of Persia, you find some similar ideas. You find it in ancient America. On the other side of the world, you see the pyramids that are built almost the same way in Egypt and halfway across the world. You find the same kinds of gods worshipped in ancient America as you do in ancient Egypt. You know, you finally have to put it together and say, hey, well, wait a minute, there's more to all of this than just a lot of accidents. There's more to it than just, a handful of people making up stories or making up myths. There's something consistent here. There's something global here, and you're exactly right. That's when you can't write it off anymore. That's when you have to start taking it seriously, and especially when people keep reporting these UFOs, there's so many times when I go onto the internet just to check on the news or read the newspapers. I so often wish I wouldn't see any more reports about UFOs. Not that they shouldn't be reported if they're being seen. Frankly, if they are being seen, I think they should be reported because I think they're an extremely important, significant phenomena. So, yes, let's keep reporting them. But on the other hand, it's very comforting to live in a world where UFOs are not real. It really is. It brings a lot of mental comfort to me to think that maybe they're not real after all. But I can't take that step because the evidence is just overwhelming that they are. So you have to just take it seriously. And the trouble is that when you do, as soon as you take that stuff seriously, and then you look at the myths, the stories, the reports, you get into all this really bizarre and extremely uncomfortable stuff. You know, it's not an easy topic to deal with at all. And quite honestly, I believe that the people who just dismiss it all, they are actually taking the road of comfort. It is much more comfortable. It's much easier to have your thoughts aligned around that. It's just nothing, and I can just go on and watch TV and not worry about things. But that's unfortunately not, I think, the evidence. The evidence is just overwhelmingly there that there is something real to all of this.
Right, right. The distractions are out there.
Do you think that human beings, if we were made by them to look like them, as it says in biblical terms, are we in some way a threat to them?
Yes. I think we are, and I think that really comes out in the old stories. I mean, look at the evidence of why we seem to be a threat to them. If you take seriously the old stories about divide and conquer, whether it's the Tower of Babel stories or the earlier stories of the Tower of Babel is based on. The need to disunite humanity was based on a perceived threat, that the human beings in a united form posed a threat to their domination or their ownership, basically their control of Earth. This is a nice piece of real estate, by the way. I mean, Earth is a pretty nice piece of real estate. And they want to hang on to it. They, you know, we think it belongs to us, but understand that if these theories are correct, in their minds, this belongs to them. And they want to hang on to it. So, yeah, they don't want us to wrest control of this from them. And then if you look at how covert they are today and how covert they started to become a long time ago, there was a time when they were reported to be very open in society. You know, they built houses for them in Egypt, and they were just there hobnobbing with the pharaohs. And, you know, there was not a lot of secrecy to their existence. But at some point, the curtain came down. They decided, well, we need to operate things differently now. Now we're going to go ahead and fall into the background and kind of manipulate things from the background. And that is because of a perceived threat. You look at even today, they are very elusive. They don't really want to be seen or known that clearly. They go to a lot of trouble to try to block out the memories of abductees. And that all tells me that they perceive a threat from us. And they don't want trouble from us. They want to be able to hang on to Earth as their possession without a lot of trouble from us. So, yeah, I think that's exactly what it is. There's fear there on their side, and but maybe for reasons that's different than what we think. Yeah. It's not because we're just this warlike race. This is the most common theory, that we've become this warlike race with the nuclear bombs, and therefore they're so afraid of us they don't want us to know their existence. No, I don't think that's it. I think they're afraid of us mostly because, you know, they want to keep control, and they realize.
So do you think they're somewhere close by that we you know, once we get technologically advanced enough that we can get to them?
Well, you know, they're so technologically advanced that. You don't even think in terms of you can solve any of this by fighting them. You know, Hollywood comes out with all these movies, which are a lot of fun, you know, like Independence Day and all these movies where the aliens show up and then we go to battle with them with weapons and we defeat them. You know, it's, of course, not that can't be done. They're way too far ahead of us technologically. I mean, the only solution, if my theory is true, the only solution is that the only thing you can hope to do is change their minds through a negotiation process or some kind of communication process that, hey, what you're doing is not, you know, it's time to stop now with all of this. It's time to do something different. And that's about the only solution that I can really see that's realistic. And even that's not very realistic because, you know, the governments don't even really acknowledge the reality. I mean, there's really not that kind of communication that I can see that anybody is prepared to do with them. Anybody who might have face-to-face contact, which would be very, very small in number, where's the opportunity? Where's the motivation for those people? So I don't realistically seeing that happen, but it's the only solution that I could really see realistically, not trying to build weapons to fight them, no.
Yeah, the scene in Independence Day where, you know, we take one of our planes and fly it into their main weapon, and it explodes, and, you know, everybody all over the world has figured it out how to take out the aliens, or the War of the Worlds scenario where they catch a cold. Just doesn't make any sense to me.
That, yeah, those are sort of stories. If they catch cold, they would have done it by now.
Yeah. If some of the stories of terraforming and things like that are true, which a lot of the ancient societies talk about, the ancient cultures talk about, is the terraforming of the planet and the addition of human beings and the constant tinkering that's done with human beings, like we're you know, hardware or laptops that need an upgrade. And, of course, the hybrid program that you're talking about, which is yet another upgrade, who knows? It's a very interesting subject, and there are many arms to it. And there does seem to be this call for disclosure, but hasn't there been this call for disclosure for generations upon generations upon generations where the people just eventually get fed up. They know in the back of their head, they know that there's stuff going on out there that they're not aware of, and somebody knows it and is not telling them about it. Like, we can take this into many areas, like the suppression of technology. And I'm talking about free energy technology, anti-gravity, stuff like that. There's inventors all over the world who have been coming up with this stuff, and they tell similar stories. These are not abduction stories, but these are similar stories of suppression, governmental, secret society, or intelligence agency suppression of their technology. Or they just get killed outright.
Yeah, I think part of that, I think there are two prongs to that. I think part of it is the king rat phenomenon. You know, if you're getting all your wealth from oil, you don't want engines that will stop running on oil. So I think that's a very significant part of it, and that probably explains a lot of that, like suppression of forms of energy that don't require some of these things. But on the other hand, you know, always in the back of my mind, I've never really talked about this before, and I didn't even talk about it in The Gods of Eden, but always in the back of my mind after I wrote this book, I always thought, okay, if this theory of the Gods of Eden is true, we are never going to be allowed to develop technology beyond a certain point. We can never become a challenge technologically to these ETs. They just would not allow that. If this is their possession and we are their creation, we'll reach a certain level and that will be it. You know, and that to me was really, and I also have said to people, listen, we're never going to be allowed to be a real spacefaring race. You know, we're never going to have these great migrations out into space if this theory is true. That, sure, we'll maybe hop to the moon and Hubble. I love Hubble, by the way. I love the pictures it's sending back. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll have like a space station, just kind of very local stuff. But that's as far as we're ever going to be allowed to go. Instead, we're just going to be brought down and just enmeshed in all of our very down-to-earth problems of war and this and that and that. And that's all we're ever really going to be allowed to do on any significant scale, if this theory is true. So that's kind of one thing, too, that I have always thought. And I think part of what you talked about may be a part of that, you know, like certain discoveries just won't be allowed to go any further. Because we cannot reach that same level of technical ability that the ETs have. And, right. And we've started taking little tiny baby steps towards that, you know, like non-locality and quantum physics, the ability to kind of do almost magical things, you know, with particles. We've just started that process. My fear has always been that once we start reaching that process, that will be the time to pull the plug on the human race to avoid the challenge to them. You can tell I kind of come from a fairly dark perspective, and I apologize for that.
It might be a numbers thing.
I'm generally a fairly optimistic person, believe it or not. For example, I do see that there are solutions, there are technical solutions to everything that's going on. We could solve the problem of our economy very quickly and easily from a strictly technical point of view, the problem of war and all of this stuff. But it's just the motivation that if there's a motivation not to allow those problems to go away because there's some benefit that somebody gets from having those problems or from suppressing, like you say, technology beyond a certain level because somebody out there has benefits from us not being able to compete or match them, yeah, that's where the problems are going to come in, not from our inability to technically solve these problems.
Yeah, I hear this a lot, that people say, well, if there are these technologies, say crash craft, and the people have gotten, the governments of the various countries of the world have gotten this ET technology and have been working on it for decades, why wouldn't they bring it out to the public? You know, it baffles people's minds to think, well, if that's true, then I would have this technology in my home, because they want to put the technology out there to make more money on it. But I don't know if that's a good answer, because if you have these sorts of things, just as an example, let's say that you had in your basement, and everybody had the availability of a box that's 12 inches across and, you know, 12 inch square that could run your house infinitely on free energy. You get the box once, okay, it's not a free energy because you have to buy the box. people have to make the box. But we're getting to our point now where we can make things on mass scales very quickly with robotics and stuff like that. So the cost would be low. It would run your house and your children's house and your children's children, you know, and it's a one-time purchase. Maybe some maintenance is required. Okay, some maintenance is required. That's fine. But you're not paying that monthly bill. And this is where I see the problem. And maybe it's not a problem. Maybe it's just one of those things that if the ground movements that are the ground level movements that are happening that get co-opted over and over and over again. Right now you have the Occupy movement, like we were talking about earlier. If the Occupy movement was running around saying, okay, we want free energy now, and energy is the basis of so many things, you know, if you had unlimited energy, what could humans achieve? You know, so suppress that. If the Occupy movement was around saying, okay, we want free energy now, that's where we're going to start with this. And secondly, we know all the greedy bastards that are in the, you know, the banking system, they need to just go away. But they're not doing that. It seems that the movements themselves are suppressed, just like the knowledge in history has been suppressed or stolen, like the library at Alexandria was robbed clean. What do you think of that?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of prongs there that I could talk to you about.
Yeah, I ramble on too.
Oh no, I love it. Let's talk about energy first. I think you're right. Our ability to create the kind of technology you're talking about, I think we were there. We're very close to it. And if we, like I said, if we took these scientists away from getting so much involved in creating drones and all this idiocy and actually put those minds to work on creating exactly the kinds of things you're talking about, we'd have them very quickly. For example, I like New Scientist magazine. I just subscribe to it. And I've seen a couple of articles during the years, recent years in there, and I think Scientific American. Even with existing technology, even with just solar panels, for example, they've already figured out, just with that technology, within 10 years, we could pretty much just get off oil just with the existing level of solar panel technology we have. We could get off oil almost altogether, power our cities with just sun, and plug in hybrid cars or plug in cars and so forth. I mean, we could create this whole infrastructure that got us away from it and got us all into solar energy. You say, well, why isn't that happening? That sounds pretty good. And that's even with solar energy being, not as developed as we're probably going to be able to make it if we really work on it. I mean, the solar panels we have today are not as efficient as I think we can make them. I think some of them only operate like a 20 or 30% efficiency. Once you get them up to 90%, which is within reach, yeah, you know, you could pretty much power the whole world, almost the whole world on that. I saw these very specific plans of exactly where you put your solar panels and what desert areas to put them in, or put them on roof, everybody's rooftop, and plug it all in, and boom, you got it in 10 years. And this was something they wrote a couple of years ago, but nothing is really seriously happening in that direction. I mean, yeah, people do it privately. There's these solar power companies, and there's some effort, but it's not to that scale where we're just getting away from it. And then you're looking at, well, again, why don't we develop these other technologies of the kind that you're talking about? Or if it is developed, why isn't it being released? I kind of agree with the people who say that, you know, if these saucers have crashed and we've been back engineering, why don't we have that technology out in the world now? Because they've been crashing at least since 1947. But there are UFO crashes reported in the literature even going back further than that, going back centuries, in fact. But let's say we started having the ability to start back engineering back in the starting the 1940s all the way up and through today. Why don't we have it? You know, it's either because there's a suppression that we just simply are not allowed to develop that far, or that's not really what's happening with these crashed disks, that they really are not back engineering them. Something else is happening to them.
Right.
So, what can you say? There, I can only speculate. Probably other UFO researchers maybe have more information on that than I do.
It seems like it's just a bunch of squirrels collecting nuts and hiding them in the tree to me. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. And one of the worries I do have about these ground-level movements is the co-option, them being co-opted, like, over and over and over. Like, get the people focused on the debt. Get them focused on the evil political guys who are running the country, who are just puppets, really. And you divert the focus over there so that people don't really go into depth of thought about what they really need to, you know, free the human race. Because this is a cycle. This is Rome. You're looking at Rome crashing again. That's all. This is nothing new. This is not a new story that's happening of the economic crashes that are going on and Greece rioting in the streets and not having enough money. It looks like they'll be out of money by the middle of November if they don't get yet another bailout. And this is just a cycle. It's a cycle that keeps happening over and over again.
Yeah, and it's so stupid, too, because it's so unnecessary. I mean, it really boils down to the kind of money that we create. The way we create and distribute money is ultimately at the root of this whole problem. And we need to get away from fractional reserve banking, which is a system that's used globally. It started a few hundred years ago. I talked about how it really came out of this weird network of secret societies and the people connected to them. And it's really designed, I think, to cause exactly what we're experiencing. You know, that we can never be allowed to be too prosperous. We can never let technology take us to the point where we have a lot of leisure. The plug has to be pulled all the time, and it is constantly. We constantly have these booms and busts. And I think the foundation for it is the type of monetary system that we've adopted that really has exactly this thing, you know, because this has been, you know, these booms and busts have been going on a long time. So you know, when you look at Occupy Wall Street, yeah, I think the people who are focused on, hey, the problem is the bankers, the problem is the politics that allows the 1% to control 40%. I think that's good. I mean, I'm glad actually to see people out there, you know, really making a fuss about this, because that is a big part of the problem. I think they're starting to look at what the problem is. But then you're right. What's going to happen to the movement? Will it get co-opted? For example, now some of the leaders say, well, we should have a one-world government as part of the solution to all of this. And that's why I kind of warn, oh, you know, there are a lot of practical reasons why you don't want a one-world government. So, you know, you got to be careful that you don't go too far afield in looking at, you know, solutions that really don't address the problem. Yeah, if the solution is to reform the monetary system, if they focus on that, I think this would be a great thing. But, yeah, if they're going to talk about all these big political movements that ultimately really don't solve the problem, then they do get co-opted. They get moved in a direction. They take that frustration, which is legitimate, and they channel it then towards a solution that is not really going to solve it for them and could even make things worse in the long run. So, yeah, that's what you got to be careful of. I'm part of the late 60s, early 70s generation that marched in some of the anti-war marches back then. And I liked a lot of the intellectual and the philosophical underpinnings of a lot of that movement. And I think it eventually did have a positive effect. Eventually, the Vietnam War did end, but wars continued anyway. It didn't end all war, which I think was really the goal of a lot of the people at that time. But it did, I think, help at least bring about the end of that one war. So if they can have that, but then, you know, the only problem then was that where do you go from there? You know, I think the drugs became a problem, and kind of wrecked the movement a little bit. So there were things that kind of got insinuated into it that I think eventually, took away some of its effect and power. And that's what people have to watch out for today. Like Egypt is a good example. You know, we had this, Mubarak got removed. And the problem, though, was that who removed them, who was behind the protesters in Egypt, it was the military. And now, you know, the military today seems to be just as bad as Mubarak was. So there was really no long-term gain. And that's what people have to be careful about. who their leaders are, and what the solutions are that they're proposing. I think they're on track looking at the right problem, but it's really the solutions that they have to really now be very careful about.
Right, right.
Anyway, that's my opinion.
You know what? The monetary system is planned obsolescence, in my opinion. It's built. The failure is built into it, purposely.
It is designed to do what I think it does, and that's just to keep us basically never able to relax. And it certainly seems to have that effect today.
Yeah.
You know, I
keep
never
them working. Keep them
Pardon me?
Keep them working, keep them entertained, and that way they won't have to, you know, go too far. If people get, you know, I work hard. I get up every day at 5 a.m. and I work a 12-hour shift and I come home and I watch TV. I'm a hardworking. Why? You're a slave is what you really are. You're saying you're a slave and you're proud of it. Oh, good for you. You know?
Yeah, see, technology was supposed to bring us to the point where we were only supposed to have to work maybe 4 hours a day. I mean, yeah, it's always going to be a need for some work. But it was supposed to relieve us of this burden. And we were supposed to be able to live in a society where our needs would be more than comfortably met and we would have a lot of leisure because machines and all of that would take care of us. The only thing that undermines that is the monetary system. The only thing that has frustrated that goal is the monetary system. And people don't realize that. And so that's why I think so you're right. It becomes a situation of like I work 12 hours a day and I'm very proud of the fact that I work from dawn until dusk, and then I watch TV. But then where's the leisure to start exploring the deeper questions? You know, like, for example, people who want to read about philosophy. The only people who can do that are people who have a little leisure time, people who want to read about, you know, the nature of reality. Who has time to do that? If you've just lost your home in a foreclosure, and you're just wondering where your next paycheck's going to come from to feed your family, you don't really have time to sit down and read a book about quantum physics and the holographic nature of reality, which is the kind of thing I'd like to see more people doing, you know, because I think that's really where we need to go. Not that everybody's going to be interested in that anyway, you know, I'm not saying everybody's going to want to read about that, but the point is that people will be able to have the leisure to kind of explore these deeper questions. And I've noticed that most people get interested in those types of things when they have the time. And the thing is, we have religions that sort of substitute for that. They kind of give you the quickie, okay, well, here, you want your spirituality? Well, go to this place and believe in an apocalypse and that, you know, all of this stuff. Which is not a good substitute for really, I think, exploring the nature of reality from a more practical point of view or more rational point of view.
Yeah.
So I think that's what's behind it. And it just seems to go on and on and on. I didn't expect that Europe would get into the kind of trouble it has been getting into. I always thought of Europe as a fairly stable place. But, yeah, they are on the same fractional reserve system of banking we are, and the plug got pulled on them just like it did on us.
Yeah.
So it's happening globally.
Well, actually, I think a lot of people had predicted that the European Union was going to collapse probably within the next 5-10 years, and I think now it seems it might end up collapsing, you know, within less than 5 years.
Good. Yeah, you know, and that kind of, I'm not sure if you want to talk about this whole idea about, you know, some people in the conspiracy field are kind of worried about one world government. And I don't know, I've never really, for the exact reason you're talking about, my theory, and basically the theory of the gods of Eden, is that we have actually been living in a kind of one world government for at least 10,000 years. You know, it's
somebody's controlling this whole system.
Yeah, it's just been kind of this hidden government that's been actually, and that keeping these divisions alive is still practical. And you see that on the more, but again, at the same time, I don't think having a politically overt one world government is a good idea either. I think we still need nation states, even if it's just, you know, if one nation state becomes a bad place to live, at least they have refuge to, you know, for in other countries for people to go. But anyway, so. But you know, we've had all of these empires throughout history. We've had basically different forms of almost one world government. You know, when Alexander conquered the known world, he created close to a one-world government at that time. And of course, he didn't capture all of Asia, like China and all there. The Mongols, when they invaded, they created something akin to a one-world government. And, yeah, there are people who do want to create a one-world government. There's no question about it. And they saw the European Union as a step to that. But on the other hand, if it's still of benefit to people to keep people fighting, if there's still that one more layer of the onion that says, yeah, we need to keep people fighting, one-world government would not be a good idea even for them. You know, they probably want to have nation states, but who could fight each other or at least be a source of conflict. But at the same time, one world government is not even a solution to that. You kind of have to kind of get rid of this underlying motive to keep people at war before you can feel safe.
Even within the one world government structure, you could design in obsolescence like uprisings and stuff like that. There would be uprisings, and you could keep the people entertained and at war with each other that way.
Well, that's kind of what I think we're seeing partially, too. You know, we've shifted from nuclear powers getting into face-offs and having these proxy wars to now we're getting into terrorism. You know, it's exactly what you're talking about. It's these groups that now become threats and that create strife and war that are not necessarily just pinned to one country or sourced in one country. They could be sourced in different countries. So, yeah, you still could have that and still have a one-world government. And I think the problem with having, for example, a one-world monetary system is that, you know, if we keep using fractional reserve banking as the one-world monetary system, it's not going to improve anything. We're still going to go through all of this stuff, you know, because that's really the problem with it. And the trouble is everybody who talks about wanting to have a one-world currency or one-world monetary system, they're all talking about just keeping the same fundamental system going. So, you know, I say, well, where's the improvement? How's that going to help anybody? It won't. We're still going to have these ups and downs. And the same people who run the current system are the ones who want to run a one-world system, you know, and why should we feel comfortable with them running it? You know, if look what a mess they're making now. What makes them better at running a one-world government? Nothing. You know, it's just going to be just what we're experiencing now. So, anyway, that's why I think we agree that, yeah, you got to watch. The solutions are very important that people propose. I mean, I think we all kind of identify the problem, but the solutions that people have are very different, and we need to look carefully at that.
I think it's a high-level chess game. Go ahead, Tom.
Sorry. What I was going to say was that, you know, one-world government will never happen and never will work because the powers that be right now, you know, one is divided and conquer. You know, the more fraction you have out there, the better for them.
Yeah, as long as divide and conquer is a useful tool, at least on the surface, we will always have, I think, divisible entities, political entities. You know, so for example, the European Union, if somebody created the European Union with a dream that this is going to lead to a one-world global government and now it seems to be breaking apart, that doesn't surprise me because the one-world government that I hypothesize has always existed is one layer deeper than that. And that the people, I kind of get the feeling like the king rats we talked about earlier and these human elites, when they propose some of these things, I think they're getting strung along like everybody else. That they're being fooled like everybody else. That they're quite stupid in many ways. I mean, they're clever in getting some of these things going, keeping the wars going, and siphoning off the money through these calamities from the king rat level. But I don't think that most of them really understand that perhaps there is that one layer deeper, and that they are promoting an agenda that really, in the long term, is really not what they're expecting. They're going to be disappointed, too. They're going to be disappointed that their version of the one-world government that maybe they want may just fall apart, like with the European Union starting with them. And I think we have maybe more countries today than we... I don't know this for sure. I haven't done the study. But, you know, when the Soviet Union broke apart, we created more countries. That grew out of that, it's possible we have more countries and more nation states today than we did before World War II. I'd have to check on that, by the way. Don't criticize me if I'm wrong on that. but it doesn't seem like we're necessarily moving towards globalization in that way. You know, yeah, the European Union, I think, was an effort to do that. We'll see what happens. Who knows? Maybe they'll just come out with their bailout and they'll manage to keep it together, but it'll be interesting.
They're running out of bailout. I mean, what they're doing is they're bailing out with monopoly money. I mean, they're just it's digital money now. It's not even real. They're just saying, here's some digital, you know, $2 billion to keep you going for another 3 months. It's designed. It's built into the system to fail, and it's built into to fail for a reason. There has to be a reason to it. This constant whack-a-mole game we're playing over and over and over again, and it's keeping us busy. It's keeping us busy. It's keeping us worried. It's keeping us in fear. It's the same thing being played over in human history going back thousands of years. This is not new.
In this kind of system that the Europeans have done, it would have worked if all the countries that were involved were on the same level of economic ability. When you have a very poor country and a very rich country, you have the same problem that we have anywhere right now, is we have the poor and the rich. You know, the same complaining that we're doing right now with this movement that's happening out there is, you know, there's no way it can work because the poor people are still going to have, you know, that problem, right?
Yeah.
So how are they going to catch up to the rich?
Yeah, and you know, the system that they've developed has not really done anything to help the poor countries. I mean, look at Greece. I like Greece. I like the Greek people. I hate to see this happening to them. But yeah, it's true that, you know, they set up this system, but it's not effective in really solving the problem. And it hasn't solved it for Greece. It hasn't solved it for anybody, really. You know, what they need to do is they need to change the way they create and issue money. They need to get rid of this fractional reserve system that they use, that everybody uses. Then you might start having some improvement because ultimately it is all just about blips on a computer screen. Exactly right. It's just ones and zeros on a computer screen translated into monetary numbers that you zip around the world and that becomes your money. I mean, you can have a system based on that, but you can't. Well, anyway, I don't want to get into the whole fractional reserve system and how it works.
I get it. Planet Earth is a big video game, and you just want more credits. That's all.
You know, if we can look at it that way, in one sense, that I think that's true. You know, you look at quantum physics that ultimately everything is illusory, and even many staid scientists are willing to say that now, that, hey, you know, a new scientist and sometimes Scientific American will have a headline on their cover, are you an illusion? Is the world an illusion? It's kind of fun. I mean, even scientists like to play with that, and they're sort of acknowledging that that's ultimately what this is, that there's nothing really solid here. It's just waves being translated into what looks to be solid form, and then we interact through this. Well, you know, I suppose if we could get to the point where we really function in our daily lives, realizing that and knowing that, maybe all of this would be easier to take. But frankly, it's hard to do because you kind of get sucked into it. You get sucked into the problems of it and kind of forget that there's at a deeper level, this really at some level isn't real. But you can't just walk away from it either because there are consequences to it, you know. If you're out of a job, you don't have any money, you don't want your body to starve. You do want to go out and get a job, so you're forced to kind of stay stuck and focused in this reality that's most scientists now will agree is somewhat illusory in how it's created. So we kind of create our own illusions and systems within this illusion, and that makes it all for a very interesting study, you know, and that's why I think it'd be very beneficial if we could learn more about that deeper level of reality, because maybe it's some much deeper level of reality that'll help us deal with the kind of superficial problems that we have. And when I say superficial, they are real problems, but they are maybe not based on the deepest levels of reality. It's just something that's being created and that can be uncreated just as easily.
Okay, I'm going to make a connection now. To, again, back to your book, The Gods of Eden. All of this stuff that's happening now, we've already talked about how this is a recurring cycle. Let's go back to, what can you tell me about the custodians or the custodial masters? How can you lay that out and connect it to today?
Well, the custodial masters are basically the ETs that appear to have control and custody of the Earth. I kind of based that on the writings of Charles Fort. He wrote a book back in 1919 called The Book of the Damned. He has a great couple of paragraphs in which he just says that he believes that we're property, that we that Earth was fought over and settled long time ago, and that we are now the property, the equivalent of livestock to whoever owns the Earth, all others warned off, and that we are guided in our mysterious usefulness by some order of people who have some connection there, and they sort of guide humanity in some mysterious way. So the custodial masters are that extraterrestrial source, that society that's out there that we seem to be a part of, that the Earth is owned by. You know, I have no clue as to how many planets they may be in custody of. I don't know how big their society might be. I don't even really speculate too much about where they might even come from, you know. I just assume that we are just sort of a small part of a bigger history, that there's this whole history going on that Earth is part of, but we're almost maybe a footnote, perhaps, and that we are just part of a much bigger program, part of a much bigger civilization that we just don't know about and that we're being kept ignorant of. So that's what I call the custodial society, that these ETs who seem to have custody, who seem to be having this effect on human society, who were said in our old creation stories, were said to have these intentions and these motivations in how they dealt with Earth and how they controlled Earth and how they controlled the human population. So that, in a nutshell, is how I define custodian or custodial entity in my book.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I just wanted to make that connection because when you were saying that people don't maybe look at that, there's a level below that, and that's what you talk about in your book. You're talking about the control structure, and there's a level beyond that, maybe an ET level, and that may be having an effect.
Exactly. I call it a level of strong influence, that human society is still being very strongly influenced through these secretive channels, and that ultimately that those channels trace back to the UFO. They trace back to whoever is flying around in the UFO. And again, that sounds pretty wild and pretty out there, and I can't believe today that I'm saying such a thing when I think back what I was trying to find when I was a high school student. Again, I try to document some of that and document the history that has led to that theory. Because you find in many of these groups today that have this influence, that are causing these effects in human society today, you're going to find people who claim connections to weird entities. You're going to find this weird subterranean world that's well-funded, where you're going to see people who are involved, like in the intelligence services, involved in these weird religions, and claiming connections that are rather bizarre. And you find stories of these men in black, you know, you find even in the UFO reports of entities that are somehow connected to military people. You know, it's pretty rare that you get a UFO abduction event where somebody claims to have seen an actual person, like a human being in a military uniform next to a little gray. But you do hear about them occasionally. And you do hear about UFOs, you read about UFOs near top secret military sites. Area 51 is the most famous of them, where they seem, you know, of course, they are experimenting with experimental aircraft, there's no doubt about that, and that's a lot of what these sightings are. But you also find reports of traditional UFO-type sightings at these very secretive locations, then connected to reports of occasionally of military people being seen with ETs in some limited number of abduction scenarios. And so you see those kinds of points of contact, as well as the people who have experienced these men in black, the phenomenon, which I think is very significant. People are visited by these men in black who kind of look kind of alien a little bit, and they kind of act a little bit weird. They kind of, but then they're maybe accompanied by, or they're wearing military uniforms, and they seem to operate with impunity. They just kind of get to drive around and do all of these things without any obstruction. And the involvement of government at this more secretive level of squelching all these reports about UFOs and not releasing information, it kind of all comes together that there is still, you know, a channel of very strong influence from them that keeps all of this alive. And that's, you know, one of the channels through which it might be done. So, and those would be the custodial entities that I would talk about, the ones buzzing around and the UFOs that are kind of skulking around. Anyway, so I try to put a little humor into all of this.
If they want to maintain that control, it makes sense that, because, you know, you hear this from people who are looking into UFOs, that, well, why don't they all just show up in our skies or land on the White House lawn, or, you know, why aren't we talking to them on a, you know, on Skype? Why aren't we just having conversations with UFO occupants on Skype and they're showing up on the evening news? Well, if you're going to maintain that sort of control structure, and if you're going to do it in such a way that you're hidden, then that answers that question, doesn't it?
Exactly. And that's the point where I tell people, read The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli. Almost every political science student in college or sociology student in college is assigned that book to read at some point or another. Read that book, and that tells you the formula for this, that the formula is you stay hidden, you secretly foment the factions, you secretly cause people that you want to control to fight amongst each other, and then you kind of hold yourself out at the same time, kind of a little bit in the background, but you kind of say to these warring factions, hey, we're the solution to your problem. We're the good guys. We're the nice guys. If you need help, we'll be there to help. And that's kind of exactly what we get from the UFOs, people saying, oh, they're the wonderful space brothers. You want nothing but peace for us. But then you have all of this other evidence suggesting another intent. So anyway, so yeah, I would say that if this sounds kind of all kind of weird to you, and you know, a lot of people don't like conspiracy theory because it's just hard to deal with. It just sounds so weird and icky, if I may use that sophisticated term. But then you got to read Machiavelli, and that's the, I think then you start to understand a little bit more about that type of control.
Now, before we close off here, can you give us a little bit of a rundown on your other book, The Jesus Goes to Hollywood?
Yeah, Jesus Goes to Hollywood has not been anywhere near as popular as The Gods of Eden. What it grew out of was The Gods of Eden. When I was writing Gods of Eden, I wrote about the foundation of Christianity in one of the chapters and about Jesus. But while I was researching it, I ran into all of these different theories about Jesus. You know, did he not exist at all? Did he study in Asia? Did he survive the crucifixion and live to be an old man? All of these different theories that people have been expressing for hundreds of years, if not since he was alive. And so I thought, it'd just be interesting just to take all these different theories and just put them into a single book and kind of give each theory its own chapter without really passing judgment on any of them. You know, what color was the skin? Was he a black man? Was he a white man with red hair? You know, all of these different things. And kind of give the main evidence for each of those theories. And so that became the book. Now the thing is, it's very hard to get. I saw it on, it's not sold normally through Amazon. And some of these sellers are charging like $80 or $100 for the book. If you're interested in buying it, get it from legendarytimes.com. They're selling it for the normal list price. I think it's $24.95 for the hardcover. Yeah, don't buy it from one of these sellers who's overcharging on Amazon. I think it's a rare book, and it's not. So anyway, and then what I did was I wrote a little fictional story to introduce each chapter, to add a little humor to it about the real Jesus has come back for the second coming. And there's a Hollywood agent that wants to represent him in the second coming. So I try to put a little humor into it. And so I introduce this little fictional story at the beginning of each chapter that talks about the Jesus, whatever Jesus theory I happen to be talking about. So anyway, that's what that book's about.
Okay. You know, what you could do is if you have PDF copies of you know, the Gods of Eden and Jesus Went to Hollywood. You could throw a link to those up, and people could just, you know, buy it through the internet, and, you know, PayPal you the money and have it that way.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Well, Gods of Eden is being published by Avon, so you can just get it in normal hardcover, and Amazon carries that at the normal price. Yeah, I don't know what to do about Jesus Goes to Hollywood. I'm doing other things now, and I'll see. I'll see if I want to put more effort into it.
Yeah, you just get a PDF version and throw it on your site. Could you tell us your website, please?
Yeah, it's not much of a website. It's just it's williambramley.com. And it's just a quick little introduction to me, and I answer a few questions. It doesn't have a lot of information there. It wasn't really designed to. Really, most of what I have to say on the topic is in The Gods of Eden. Just read that book.
And great book. I highly recommend it. Get the other book as well if you guys can find it. Or you can know any of the information on William will be in our archive section the day after the interview at www.spectrumradionetwork.com. You can just click on past guests and you'll be able to listen to William's interview, and you'll be able to click on the links in there. We have what I'll probably do is I'll track down some links to your books and I'll put those in there as well. Why don't you email me the ones you think people should be using, especially when you mentioned the exorbitant prices that people are charging for your books. If you give me a link to the one that's just charging regular price, that'd be great, and I'll put that in the archives.
Great, I'll get it to you.
That's great. Okay, I think we're at the end of our show. I really want to thank you. I'm glad we got to a lot of the areas that we did, because we seem to jump around a lot, but we covered a lot of areas. We went from ancient history to ancient UFOs to UFOs today, to the various movements and the suppression of knowledge. And that's an important thing, because this does seem to be a reoccurring thing, the suppression of knowledge. Keep it secret. Join the secret society. We'll give you the goods. You know, it happens over and over, doesn't it, Tom?
For sure. For sure. And it will be, I think, all along.
Yeah, they just have different names. Templars, Rosicrucians. We once had a guest on, just as a side note, we once had a guest on that said, if it's such a secret society, how is it that you know about it?
Exactly.
Yeah, the real secret societies we don't know about. That's true.
Exactly. And maybe it does have a connection to what you're talking about, is the ancient alien theory. Hey, who knows?
Yeah.
You know, we just have to keep our eyes open, be open to the possibilities, but always be aware that there's perhaps something going on in the background that we don't know about and we're not meant to know about. So I'd like to thank you for joining us. Thanks for coming on the show, William.
Okay, thanks very much. Have a good day.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, I enjoyed talking to you, too.
And I'll see you guys next week.
Next.
Bye-bye.